as Dr. Watkins's students put it so concisely in their story maps, while global food production is ample, mm-hmm. food distribution and access remain unjust. Mm-hmm. Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymie Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, food insecurity and food justice. Hello. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Well, hi there. It's been a while since we've been in the recording studio. You listeners won't be able to tell.
They won't know.
A gap, but
no, yeah. They will not know.
We had to finish that book.
We did. We had to. Mm-hmm. We finished the book and turned it in, so mm-hmm. now we can focus again on the podcast.
But oh, yeah.
We have so many episodes banked mm-hmm. that you will not even miss us because we'll still be on our two-week schedule.
Yes, you will notice no interruption in your service.
Okay, well, that's a good way to get us started yeah. since the topic is kind of sad today.
True.
Yeah. We are recording this on May 8th. Is today May 8th? Yes. Mm-hmm. And the United Nations, which we have discussed on previous episodes, is reporting that parts of Gaza are now experiencing a full-blown famine after seven months of war between Israel and Hamas. So we had food insecurity and food deserts on our list, so I thought we would just kind of move it up given what's going on in the world. And, you know, we try mm-hmm. not to talk too much about what's happening contemporarily mm-hmm. in our podcast because we want these to sort of stand the test of time. So you can always pick an episode and find out something about food justice mm-hmm. without it being linked to a certain specific point in time. These issues, of course, are the reasons why we choose the topics that we do.
Sure.
Yeah. So, Ben, do you know what needs to happen before a famine can be officially declared?
Nope. No idea. Okay. But I can guess. So if I'm thinking about like, okay, if I imagine what would be the criteria for a famine, I could imagine on the one hand, it might be like you would count the number of people who are either, you know, like going without food or starving or
right.
hungry.
Yes.
So it would be like a people-based count. Or I could also see it being kind of like a resource count, like resource deprivation measure of like the lack of food or for a, you know, specified time or something. Anyway, right. those are my guesses, but just guesses. But the word famine is pretty
old.
Old specific. I specifically always think about like the Old Testament story of Joseph when we talk about famine, and mm-hmm. there was like the he was like sold into slavery by his bros because they were jealous of his coat of many colors.
Yes.
And then he ended up in Egypt, and the Pharaoh had the dream about like the seven fat cows on the banks of the river, and then these seven skinny cows came up and ate them.
Yeah.
And Joseph interpreted his dream and said that meant 7 years of famine. Oh, so anyway, that's what I always think about when I hear the word famine.
Well, thanks for inserting mm-hmm. that interesting story for our listeners. Maybe they'll remember
Certainly.
That. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the famine reports are coming from the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, which is a global initiative that assesses hunger and famine around the world. And it said nearly a third of Gaza's population was experiencing the highest level of catastrophic hunger, and that could rise to nearly half by July. Mm. So the next IPC report is expected in July. Israel, of course, strongly rejects any claims of famine in Gaza. But they're also concerned about having a formal declaration because this could be used as evidence at the International Criminal Court, as well as the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, where Israel faces allegations of genocide in a case brought by South Africa, as we discussed in a previous episode. Mm-hmm. So according to the IPC, an area is experiencing famine when three things occur.
What did you say the IPC was?
It's the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. So IFSPC, mm-hmm. but it's just, I guess they just shorten it to IPC.
I was looking through my notes for like, and like, it said IFC. So anyway,
for whatever reason, they just like knocked out the food security part.
My bad. Anyway.
That's okay. That's a good question, though, because our listeners probably also were like, WTF. Mm-hmm. Okay. 20% of households have an extreme lack of food or are essentially starving. So that's the first thing that mm-hmm. needs to occur. The second is that at least 30% of children suffer from acute malnutrition or wasting, meaning they're too thin for their height. Mm-hmm. The third criterion is that two adults or four children per every 10,000 people are dying daily of hunger and its complications. Mm.
So, yeah, it is based on the number of people that are hungry or starving then.
Yes.
My first guess was right, although I didn't know the exact number, but yeah.
Right. Okay. So the UN World Food Program is reporting one has been met, two is almost met, and three is an issue because right now the number of deaths cannot be verified due to any cause. Mm-hmm. But the situation is dire. Humanitarian groups say famine can only be averted at this point with a ceasefire since aid is not getting through or it's not getting to the people who need it. And even after, there will be long-term consequences for pregnant women and children specifically. Mm.
So before we dive into this discussion a bit more about food justice, let's define some of these concepts for our listeners.
Let's do that. So let's start with food security. Would you like to define that, please?
Sure. So food security, that's when you like have a guard llama to protect your like cows and chickens and livestock. So rama llama ding dong, food is secure. Is that right?
No, that's not it.
Oh, okay. Well, let me try again then. Okay.
Try that one again.
How about this one? Food security as defined by the United Nations Committee on World Food Security. So food security means that at all times people have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets both their food preferences and dietary needs for an active and healthy lifestyle.
Correct. There's actually a global food security index that measures four things. Affordability, availability, I almost made those one word, quality and safety, and sustainability and adaptation. So agricultural production is threatened by all kinds of environmental factors, including climate change and price shocks. So the 2022 report ranks the U.S. number 13. And global food security overall has been trending down.
So 13, does that mean that like 12 other nations have more food security than us?
Yes.
So that like 13 is high on the list?
Yes.
So we're pretty high on the list?
Yes. The top 13, all of the nations above us are, you know, democracies, industrialized nations.
Gotcha. So there are what about like 200, 195 countries in the world and we're 13?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Pretty high.
I'm not sure if the, if the index does every country, probably they can't get information on some of these factors.
Sure.
But yeah, anyway, so we are high on the list, but you think we might be higher. But I'd like to throw this out there.
We're not in the top 10.
After I introduce Dr. Watkins, I'm going to mention prison, which is going to tie this to another episode.
Oh,
so, but as we know, food security is not evenly distributed in many nations, including the U.S. So, but next, let's discuss food deserts.
Yeah, so a food desert is an area where people have limited access to a variety of healthful foods. And this could be because of either like limited income or distance from healthful and affordable food. So I also had to look up like healthy versus healthful because I hadn't really encountered like healthful.
Healthful is an interesting word choice. Yeah.
But healthy is a descriptive of people and healthful is a descriptive of basically the food. So healthy is a descriptive of person, someone who's in good health, and healthful is descriptive of the food, which means that the food is health giving or causing good health or very delicious and highly nutritious.
Delicious and nutritious. Yeah. So the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture. I'm not sure if I needed to say that, but just for, especially for our global listeners, you know, for the person who listens to us from the Philippines, this is the USDA. They define a food desert as an area that has either a poverty rate greater than or equal to 20%, but there are also other criteria. So in urban areas, at least 500 people or 33% of the population must live greater than 1 mile from the nearest large grocery store. So again, just to reiterate, that's 33% of the population that do not have a grocery store within a mile from where they live.
Yeah. They're in a food desert.
Yes. In rural areas, at least 500 people or 33% of the population must live greater than 10 miles. So in rural areas, you know, there's more, there's more space there, but a food desert can still be defined in rural areas if you live more than 10 miles from the nearest largest grocery store. Experts estimate that around 23.5 million people in the U.S. live in low-income areas that are farther than 1 mile to the nearest large grocery store. So that's a lot of people living in food deserts.
Yeah, and we're still as high as 13. So
yes,
that must mean there's a lot of people living in food deserts across the whole world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So regions with the following characteristics are more likely to become food deserts: having a very large urban areas, for example, or very sparse populations.
Yeah.
Low income, obviously, high levels of unemployment, inadequate access to transportation, and a low number of food retailers providing fresh produce at affordable prices.
Yeah.
So the report also notes that rural areas located in the West, Midwest, and South of the U.S. are much more likely to be food deserts than rural areas located in the Northeast. This may be because rural areas... That's getting harder to say. The more.
I saw this, I think it was like a YouTube video or something.
Yeah.
It said that rural is the hardest word in the English language to pronounce.
Yeah. For non-native speakers.
Well, just
and
in general,
for native speakers.
Yeah. I'm native and I can't say rural. Rural. You have to like really slow it down. Yeah. It sounds like you're saying rural.
Yeah. It's
anyway,
difficult.
That's a hard word.
Rural hard word, hard listeners. Word. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, in these areas in the Northeast, they tend to be closer to urban areas containing grocery stores. Yeah.
So even if people have access to healthy food, it still has to be affordable, right?
Right.
Yeah, so you can live close to a grocery store, but if you can't afford it, then you can still be in a food desert. I was thinking about like how expensive groceries are, and especially fresh produce. Like, it's outrageous. And it's so much cheaper to buy like frozen or super processed food.
Oh yeah.
Even if you live close to a good grocery store, but you know, you can only afford to shop at the dollar store.
Right.
Or I guess if like 33% or more of people can only afford to shop at the dollar store, then it's a food desert.
Yes. So, we'll talk about that in just a second, but, so we want to talk about the term food desert. Some advocates and researchers have taken exception to using the term because it focuses on what a community lacks and implies a barren area rather than a place where people are struggling.
Yeah. You can ride through a food desert on a horse with no name.
Mm-hmm. A desert is also a natural phenomenon rather than a social and economic condition.
Yeah.
And using the word desert doesn't adequately describe the underlying causes of inequity and lack of access.
Yeah, it just sounds like it's like, oh, it's just a desert. It's where it is and that's just the way it is.
You're just not close enough for food.
Yeah.
How about you move? You know?
Like, yeah, I can see that. It sounds like it's putting the responsibility on like the people who live in the desert.
Yeah, because it's your choice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So different terms have been offered, such as food apartheid or supermarket redlining, which addresses the issue of neighborhood access in a more pointed way. Other cities have adopted their own terms. For example, Baltimore City uses the term healthy food priority areas.
Oh, that's good.
So HFPA. Mm-hmm. So that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
So Ben, where did your mother shop for food when you were growing up?
So we had, two grocery stores in the town of Pound when I was growing up, but they were like small local chains. Yeah. There was a Sava's, which they had like a full deli in there. So they cooked hot meals in there, like fresh hot meals in there every day. And then Rex's. And that was
which is funny because my dad's name is Rex.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So Sava's and Rex's were the, grocery stores in Pound, but we had like a Food Line and a Piggly Wiggly in Wise, which is about 20 minutes away. So if it was like a, you need to do something quick from the grocery store, you go to the Pound or you had like your weekly errand trips to go to Wise.
Yeah. So the situation where I grew up, it's much different now. Back then there was like a Food Mart, Piggly Wiggly. You still have a Kroger and other grocery store chains. The Kroger's still open, but Walmart has replaced almost everything. And there are like a gazillion dollar stores and Family Dollars.
Yeah. So we had Walmart and Family Dollar pop up when I was in my teens, I think. And of course, you know, I said Pound, like that's like way in the mountains, way in the country, super rural. So, you know, we did grocery shopping, but both of my grandparents had like huge gardens. And, you know, like, so we had fresh vegetables from the garden every summer.
Right,
and they would can, you know, like my grandmother would can. So we had, you know, like garden vegetables all winter long also. So, you know, we had to like hoe corn and dig potatoes and string beans.
Fun
like,
times.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about like May 8th. So we both of us just entered our final grades today, which is
we did.
So exciting. But when I was a kid, I actually used to dread summers a lot because that meant I had to mow and I had to work in the garden all summer. Yes. And I would actually rather be in school than do that.
I don't blame you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now, for example, my mother shops at Dollar Store or Family Dollar because those are in fact closer than the Walmart, which is a couple miles away. But in March, and this is happening in communities across the U.S. In March, the Dollar Tree announced plans to shut 1,000 stores. Mm-hmm. Most of the closures are Family Dollar stores, which the one by my house here in Harrisonburg just closed, and I didn't know, and I stopped there to get something, and I was like, oh, it's closed.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
It was where the Rite Aid was. It was Rite Aid, and then it became Family Dollar. Yeah, so 600 are slated for closure before the end of the year. And another 370 Family Dollar stores and 30 Dollar Tree stores will close in the following years. And the fear is that the closures are going to leave even more of a void and increase food insecurity in some parts of the country. Now, of course, they don't get fresh fruit there. You cannot buy fresh food at Dollar Tree or Family Dollar. Yeah. It's all processed, boxed, canned stuff.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, it's not good. Yeah. It's not good quality. It's not good healthful food to begin with at the dollar store.
No.
But it is food.
It is food, right.
And shutting those places down is going to make it harder for people.
Yeah, it's better than starving. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk a bit about food justice now.
Mm-hmm.
So the food justice movement works to ensure universal access to nutritious, affordable, and culturally appropriate food for all, while advocating for the well-being and safety of those involved in the food production process. So this is important because the food justice movement does not just care about the type of food we eat and have access to, but also the people who are farming our food and making our food and working in factories. So the movement aims to address disparities in food access, particularly for communities of color and low-income communities, by examining the structural roots of our food system. So food justice addresses questions of land ownership, agricultural practices, distribution of technology and resources, workers' rights, and the historical injustices that communities of color have faced. Food justice is closely intertwined with the environmental justice movement and sustainability movements.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is where we get give a shout out to our colleague, the fantastic Dr. Case Watkins, who teaches a course on food justice.
Yeah, go Case.
Yes, so Case really emphasized that he's moved to calling food security food sovereignty. And so I'll define that in just a second. But in this class, students are working with community nonprofits. And so they have done some amazing projects, which we'll talk about in just a second. But the information that I'm going to talk about related to food sovereignty comes from the work his students did in their class.
Nice.
So we'll link to their websites in the show notes.
In my senior seminar class this year, I always ask them, like, what was your favorite justice studies class? And a lot of people pointed to Case's environmental justice class.
Aww.
And several people chose their senior seminar paper topic based on that.
That's
so I had
very
one
cool.
do redlining and one do, like, indigenous cultural ecological knowledges.
Yeah.
So
the term food sovereignty was coined by La Via Campesina, which is a global organization of small farmers. And food sovereignty means the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and their right to define their own food and agriculture systems. So La Via Campesina was founded in 1993. It's an international movement bringing together millions of peasants, landless workers, indigenous people, pastoralists, fishers, migrant farm workers, and small and medium-sized farmers, rural women, and peasant youth from around the world.
Well, that just sounds like a lovely, like, Bob Ross painting or
doesn't
something.
It? Yeah. Yeah, it does.
All those nice, like, pastoral, like, people just living
peasants.
Together in nature.
Yes.
Peasants.
Holding hands, drawing happy little trees.
Yeah.
Built on a solid sense of unity and solidarity, it defends peasant agriculture for food sovereignty. So this semester, he taught a community-based research practicum that sponsored a volunteer work day at Jubilee Climate Farm here in Harrisonburg. And these are students who are former environmental justice studies students in his class.
Mm-hmm.
They started the project and then just continued it through the semester.
Nice.
The Jubilee Climate Farm is a project of Vine and Fig, that works towards social, environmental, and climate justice, all based in the ideals of food sovereignty, land equity, and mutual empowerment. Anywho, I'm going to link to the story maps his students created about JCF, which are fantastic. Mm-hmm. I encourage all of our listeners to go to the show page and look at what these students created. The story maps are visually stunning and very informative. So the mission of the JCF is the transformation of agricultural systems to become key solutions to the climate crisis while providing land access, empowerment, and education for recent immigrants, students, local farmers, and others who wish to collaborate. So as we discussed previously in Ocean Trash and Climate Justice episodes, environmental racism is also key to understanding justice issues, and that's also true with food justice or injustice as well. Students in his classes also consider how food injustice manifests in Harrisonburg with limited access to resources in areas such as the Northeast neighborhood, the city's most prominent and long-standing African-American community.
Yeah, I took some time to look through these maps yesterday. Like you said, they're really good, really great project. And I certainly don't understand a whole lot about kind of like the history of, you know, residential segregation, but certainly laws and policies have worked to create areas that are largely filled with, you know, poor folks of color in particular. And that's also the case here in Harrisonburg at home. And then looking at these maps, it's kind of, it's pretty stark to see the differences in terms of like where the food is and how it's like, you know, not in these neighborhoods.
Yes.
So like the students placed these, you know, markers on the map that showed where either like free meals were, where you could go get free meal, or where grocery stores or convenience stores were. And then they, you know, like color coded the neighborhoods based on like the proportion of black residents. And it's just like really visually striking how much these, you know, poor communities, how there are no dots in those areas.
Yes.
Where,
so it's a visual example of like the food desert situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even though it's not that far to get to, like, even in those neighborhoods, it's still not that far to get to Food Lion or Dollar Store here. But also, you know, a lot of people lack transportation. And, you know, we do have a system of public transportation. But, you know, you see like people waiting at the bus stop or like carrying their groceries on the, you know, walking down the side of the road. It really makes you recognize the privileges that you have. And I'm pointing the finger at myself there. Like,
absolutely. You know. Absolutely. And there was a grocery store in that neighborhood and also a Family Dollar, and both closed. Mm. So yeah, again, just another example.
Yeah. I mean, corporations, they got to put these places where the money is.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Got to make that dollar.
So the interesting thing about prison, I was going to say, is that Case mentioned that to me in terms of like moving away from the language of food security or insecurity to food sovereignty, because you can have food security in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they follow what the schools follow in
terms
of
three hots in a cot.
Three hots in a cot.
Yep.
So that's food security, but not food sovereignty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my grandmother, she used to say, like, we should just make prisoners grow gardens and grow their own food.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
absolutely.
It would keep them, you know, busy, keep them occupied, doing something pro-social and eating healthy.
Yeah. So. And there's something to be said for, like, you know, like the satisfaction that comes from watching your own garden come to life.
Yeah.
I've experienced it vicariously through others because, like I said, I don't want to farm.
Well, I was getting ready to say, Tommy, quite contrary, how does your garden grow?
It doesn't. That's it.
Okay, that's it?
Yeah.
We're going to stop there, nothing else?
No.
Okay, well then I guess we'll get to our Minute to Spin It, where we give our takeaway from today's show. So Tommy, what's your spin in just a minute?
My spin is, as Dr. Watkins's students put it so concisely in their story maps, while global food production is ample, food distribution and access remain unjust. For our locals, I would encourage them to find out what's happening in our community and also find out what's happening locally in your community, dear listener.
Yeah.
Ben, what's your spin?
Okay, I'm going to channel my inner Elvis here. And his mama cries, because if there's one thing that she don't need, it's another hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto.
In the ghetto.
So anyway, talking about hungry mouths to feed and crying. No mama's crying, no hungry mouths. With how much food we produce in this world, no one should be hungry in this day and age. People should have access to good, healthy food. Food sovereignty.
Yes. We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website linked in show notes to see how you can support our educational programming.